Go. This is the Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose on July the 14th, 2000. Our speaker is Charlie R. of San Jose, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
I'm Charlie Arndt. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
I'm grateful to be here tonight. Billy, my sponsor's here tonight, and he put a little moniker up next to my name that got me into a little bit of trouble because often psychology in AA is it's a word that, like the Catholic Church or the Catholic, experience. A lot of people are recovering from that. People have complaints about their experiences with psychologists and so forth. And I've been a psychologist for quite a while, actually, and I never really made that much of an open statement that I made to people because when I was in sales and also teaching, I didn't really want the people that I was selling to know that I was also a teacher, and I've been teaching for about 24 years, actually. And clinical psychology is not my area, but Billy, in his wisdom as not only my sponsor but agent, if there's animosity towards psychology in AA, it's probably to a large extent well deserved because. In my own experience with this, I mean, after all, here's the irony of this situation. This is an area where I have advanced educational training and so forth, something that I profess as a job that I do, but yet it didn't really offer an answer to me with that hobby of mine that had gotten a little bit out of control. And what I'm talking about is drinking. I didn't really have a problem with drinking. I had just, I was spending a little too much time. My life was kind of getting in the way of my drinking, that hobby that I call it. You know, it was a something that I did as a diversion. It was, it was kind of a sideline. And the another ironic thing is that the term psych or psyche in Greek means soul, and psychology never really delivered much of a soul to me or a connection to God, and that was absolutely one of the biggest problems that I had in not being able to make my life work the way I wanted it to. Not to get you people and those people out there, really, most of them, the normal people, to function in a way that would suit me and would make, my life... work properly. If they just did what they were supposed to do, then everything would be hunky-dory for me, but it didn't work out that way. I essentially was, as I was growing up, I was a kid who was instructed by my parents to be self-sufficient. And that serves you only so well, I think, and it exacerbated and made worse that problem that ultimately became so big that I needed a spiritual solution. I needed a solution that I couldn't find in psychology. But I want to say this, for those of you who, you find the God part of the program to be, just to digress here for a minute, the God part of the program... gets a lot of people uncomfortable when they first come in. And, the concept of psychology and going to counseling and so forth may get you uncomfortable and so forth when you come in. But don't let that prevent you from getting what this program has to offer. Because if you walk out of here without the opportunity giving yourself the chance to let this program work for you, I think that's a tragedy. Frankly, I'm not sure why it worked for me. I stand here before you tonight and I tell you that I am a grateful alcoholic, because this program really taught me how to turn a liability into an asset. I didn't think it was a liability, but it turned out to be a liability. My life wasn't working, and the more I tried to make it work, the clearer it became to me that the problem wasn't other people that might be here at home. So keep coming back. A little number of new people that are in here tonight, you know, and if at some point you've heard enough of what I have to say, or my story doesn't match yours, do at least the simplest thing that I did in my resistance to coming to this program. I came back another night, and I gave myself a chance to hear, you know, somebody else's story. So if my story doesn't have a piece of information in it that you connect with, then don't let that stop you, because I don't want to be, I don't think anyone in the program wants to stand in the way of you getting this gift. And I say it's a gift because it comes from, in my experience, that spiritual connection. The program helps us to develop that. So this meeting goes to 10 o'clock or so. That's probably, I'm going to need that much time, actually, to tell my story. Is everyone able to hear all right? I am the European drinker, you see. If you start out in AA, as soon as I got the big book, the first thing I noticed is, it's big. You know, it is big. I thought, God, there's a lot of material in there. And I didn't really want to do what was suggested. I was kind of one of these contrarian people that, there are those people that will help you to make your experience better in the world. And I was one of those people that would do everything they could to screw your experience up, meaning that I like to be critical. And it was really... it was one of my alcoholic defects. I didn't call it an alcoholic defect as a kid. I guess I was just a pain in the ass, more or less. But when I got this book, I went to the back of the book and started reading the stories. And the one that intrigued me was a European drinker. And I've come to realize that, to a certain extent, I fit that sort of framework a little bit. I was born in France, actually. My children are the only members of my family that have been born in this country. They're the first generation. And I was born in Orléans, France, and my father was Danish, so a Viking guy after the war married a French woman. And, it was the chocolates. I always kid my mom about this. I don't really say that to my dad, but, the chocolates and stockings and so forth was a common lure for the GIs to attract women who had been in occupation for a long time. So my mom evidently fell for that. And being born in France, I grew up really not speaking English. And right away, my parents, of course, being good new immigrants, came to the U.S. and they came from New York out to California, and they settled right out here on El Camino. They bought a house, and that was a good thing. And my father wanted English to be spoken in the house, and there was a tradition in our family, which was a European family, of drinking. I mean, that drinking went with it was the kind of drinking that was gentlemanly drinking. I mean, you drank, you held your liquor, and but everything that you did. I slowly but surely acquired this relationship. More or less everything you did with alcohol. I saw alcohol at lunch. If my parents were having some European concoction of sandwiches or whatever, there was the red wine there. My mother was French. My father loved red wine and so forth. I watched that. I didn't really drink when I was younger. My father was in the military. So being a good military man, drinking goes with that whole framework. At the end of the day, there's a happy hour, and there are farewell parties where drinking occurs, and if a new person comes into the command, you drink for just about every experience. That was really the way alcohol was used in the 50s, and I learned to use it that way. Don't get me wrong, I'm not blaming my parents here. I'm not a victim of my family. Actually, I had an excellent family, a good family experience, and I calculated roughly that I've consumed somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 55,000 alcoholic drinks in the roughly 25 years that I was drinking. And I drank every one of those myself. I didn't have anybody jacking my elbow up, so I don't have anyone to blame, really. And maybe if you be alcoholic, finding somebody to blame is, that's one of the common avocations. That's the job of the alcoholic. I mean, finger pointing and so forth, and looking, well, you come into a meeting like this and you go, these people aren't like me. They're a bunch of, as Billy would say, a bunch of lops. I don't need these idiots. Jesus Christ, I just, I got in a little trouble. Got a DUI. I mean, what's the problem with that? I mean, I shouldn't have been drinking, but I was, but I don't have a problem. You know, and I often said, hey, if people would complain, usually it was family members, if they said, hey, you kind of drink a lot. I said, well, it's a, this is a hobby of mine, if you understand. And so, who could complain if you are into your hobby after all? And I'll talk a little bit more about that hobby part, but being a kid living here, and I was stationed in the Presidio, where my father was, and we lived up there, and it was a different world in those days. Didn't do a lot of drinking, but I did get a sense that I didn't quite fit in. There was that. It's a common story, I think, with alcoholics. This sense of ill at ease, trouble being in your own skin. I didn't fit in because, one of the first things that happens, I went to kindergarten and my mother kind of spoke funny. So, the idioms and so forth with French and English. I went there and asked a kid to pass me the CISOs the first day of school. And the kid said, CISOs? And they started laughing at the new kid, can't speak English. And, I didn't quite have the hip lingo. I wasn't, squared away quite yet. And I didn't really know what was happening. In retrospect, I look at that and I think I felt apart from. And I wanted to fit in so bad and be like the other kids. I want to be Americanized. That was a big thing with immigrants at that time, I think. Blend in. Don't stick out. Try to blend in. My story involves really going to a lot of different schools. I went to four different high schools. I drank honed my drinking skill in at least three of those. We traveled all over the world. It's an experience I wouldn't give back for anything, but I also got the opportunity to experience a lot of, it would be called poor parenting, in the sense that children weren't watched all the time, and the attitude of parents towards consumption of alcohol was a little different. I remember when I was 16, 17, drinking with my father at the officers' club, because you could. It was in Germany, and if you brought your son in there and he looked old enough, what the hell, go ahead, and you're just drinking beer after all. It's not having hard liquor, so it's probably okay. I moved from California out to Illinois. I went to excellent schools out there. I had been an A student out here in California, and then all of a sudden, I was a C student in Illinois. I mean, those schools were tough, and I struggled to sort of fit in there. The community was a wonderful one. We left from that situation, and I went into my first experience with alcohol. We traveled to Japan and Korea. I was I was going into the ninth grade, and when you live in Korea, first of all, I want to walk away from this mic so badly, but it's because I can't stand still. So, the first thing I found out about being there is one of the things the kids did on the weekends was you know, drinking. You went into the teen club. If you're going to be cool and go into the teen club, which was a nice mainstay of most military bases, this base in Korea was pretty much a sealed facility, and if you wanted booze, you had to get a GI to buy it for you, or you could go downtown, and we did that. You could go downtown with the money of that time, which was script. It was paper nickels, paper dimes, and so forth. I can still remember the color. Like, the quarter was a blue paper, a little bigger than the dime. The dime was green, and the nickel was sort of a red color. And what the Koreans downtown really wanted was American greenbacks. They didn't really know what that looked like because the government wasn't really providing open use of American greenbacks at the time. So we found that you could go downtown with a stack of paper money you got from the PX, fake, you know, the fake money, the money that said right on the top, non-negotiable, and you could pay your cab fare down there, go to a hotel bar, sit in there and drink, and pay your whole tab using this money. And that they, you know, they didn't, most of them hadn't seen greenbacks, they took it. And so that party went on for quite a while. My first, you know, getting over is something that's probably part of most alcoholic stories too. Loving the idea of getting over on somebody, hiding a drink on them. I'm loaded, and you don't know I'm loaded, and you know, and so on. All of that sort of double life experience that alcoholics love to involve themselves in. You know, the life of the alcoholic often is more work than anything that it sure has been for me, anyway. Anything that I've experienced in the sober world. Going back to that life, man, I mean, that's a job. Staying loaded and maintaining a level of alcohol that you needed, man, that's a job. You always got to be thinking about what you're doing and so forth, and who you lied to and who you told what to in order to maintain this sort of flimsy veil of normality that we have, we alcoholics. I think I probably speak for most alcoholics when I say that undoubtedly you lived a double life to a certain extent, didn't you? And the only thing for me later, so I had the job, and I pointed that I got a job, I'm going to work, you know. I mean, until I saw a documentary on TV that said, well, for the alcoholic, the job is usually the last thing to go. And I thought, oh, wow, that's not really a good measure of how well, you know, my drinking career is going. Maybe I ought to taper off. Anyway, this experience in Korea was this was wonderful because I hadn't had any hard liquor before, and you could get Korean whiskey downtown. It was my first experience of getting really drunk, and I ended up going home. So many people were pushing and pulling on me. I remember being all sorts of different places, but I ended up going home in an MP car that night. And fortunately, it was some GIs that you know, were friends of friends, and they put me in between the screen door and the door, and they knocked, and I fell in. And I think to this day, my mom, she wanted to stay in denial about what was really going on, but there was a smell in my room that, wow. I went home. Every button on my shirt had the cloth pulled through it. The buttons were gone, but the shirt wasn't open. And I realized after that, I never want to get that drunk again. Man, getting that drunk? No, that's not fun. Because as soon as you got that drunk, the fun was over, and, you know, being at the teen club and dancing and being cool. I mean, nobody could smell that you had alcohol in your breath if you were laying out back in the alley. And that was the coolest thing, to have people notice that, wow, you got beer, where'd you get it? You know, yeah, we got connections, man. And you had your 12-pack. That was like four guys sharing a 12-pack. I learned to do a lot of things in Korea that, you know, a kid that was 13 years old probably shouldn't be involved in, but it was a different time. A lot of marijuana you could get downtown, too. It wasn't really my drug of choice. I seemed to like the alcohol. I didn't really like the taste. I liked the effect. I guess later I learned to like the taste more, or I associated the two and decided, oh, yeah, this is great. Love this. I think most of the time I drank for the effect. Although, as a connoisseur of liquor, I would tell you, oh, no, no, no. I know my booze and so forth. And I'm a moderate drinker, but, I like to drink in a way that, of course, demonstrates how sophisticated I am and, this kind of behavior. The intellectual giant that I was continued to help me believe that, of course, I didn't have a problem. So I lived in Korea for 2 years or so, moved to Virginia, ended up in Hawaii. No, actually, there's one more story there I should tell you. My first arrest occurred in Korea. I didn't get arrested that first night I was drunk, but I got arrested for telling my parents, circle of friends, we all told our parents we were staying at each other's house. And we managed to get all that we needed that night. We were going to spend the night in a sand tower, and it was going to be a marvelous drunk. Well, that sand tower was right next to a building that was being observed by the criminal investigation arm of the military police, and they saw us going up there. And if we drank all the beer we had in there, we probably would have fallen out of that sand tower. And so I ended up going home that night. My mom slapped me in front of the guys, which was a terrible experience. There I was with my share of the beer, which I had to take home, and she told me, "You're going to consume all of this in front of me." And I think that was the first drink I ever refused for a long time. I said, "No, Mom." So I sat there and poured them out. And there was a time or two down the road I was thinking, "What the heck was I thinking? God, wasn't one of those alcoholics that." Made promises and so forth about stopping and then pouring all the booze out. No, I was a maintenance drinker. I never had a problem. I just had a hobby. Okay, so I ended up traveling. I went to high school in Korea, went to high school in Japan, Hawaii, Virginia, and Germany. And I'm in Hawaii now, and you show up in the middle of the school year, sort of a military family moves around anytime, anywhere. We showed up, and it was really hard to fit in. My parents always liked to get cheap places to live, reasonable places to live. So they often we often ended up living in areas that from their perspective, this is a great place to live. We were living on the west shore of Oahu, and there were mostly locals there. But the rent of the house was great, and I didn't understand what these locals were saying. First day of school that I showed up, the local guys told me, "Hey, howly boy, what you doing?" And I couldn't understand what they were saying. I said, "Excuse me? Howly boy, what you doing?" I said, "I'm going to school." "Not today, howly boy. This is Kill Howly Day. First day of school is Kill Howly Day. If it's the 7th of December, it's Kill Japanese Day." So I found that hanging on the beach, though, I had a common thread with these people. I eventually hooked up, found out, where the party was. Some experience with other substances, certainly part of my story as a result of that. Experiencing those beach parties and getting extremely blasted on cheap red wine was something I realized also I didn't want to do again. So I made a commitment to learn how to drink like a mature person, like I had seen so many other individuals do, to handle their liquor and so forth. And I continued that pattern. Went to a wonderful high school in Germany where once I was in the land of the beer connoisseur, and I fit in perfectly there. Drinking was a weekly ritual, going downtown and having beer wherever and whenever. That was the sort of icing on the cake for every activity was, heading downtown, piling in a bunch of cars and heading down to the gas house or what have you, and playing drinking games and so forth. And I got to tell you, on the surface, that may have appeared to be fun. At least that was the interpretation. But in all the times that I found myself drinking, I never really got any closer to anyone. I was always, in a sense, obscured from making a real connection with someone by alcohol. I also had an excuse for my behavior, which you know, was beginning to show that sort of extreme pattern at times after an individual's had a lot to drink. And so I more or less maintained a steady diet of alcoholic drinking in my senior year in high school. And everybody did. And so, you know, as far as me interpreting it as a problem, I didn't. I didn't see it as a problem within my family. Most of my family gatherings were parties and opportunities, really, to drink. I mean, knocked down, I was telling Billy D earlier, arguments and so forth at the dinner table after dinner that involved politics and, you know, religion and arguments of that sort centered around alcohol were common. And so we'd just hear the volume going up louder. We were not a quiet family. There was a lot of yelling and screaming, a lot of intense sort of emotionality, a lot of turmoil. I realized later that I really liked turmoil. I preferred turmoil instead of tranquility and peace and serenity. And so you can imagine, after I started to get a little bit of serenity when I came into the program, I didn't know what to do with it. I wanted to set fire to something. I wanted to stir something up. I wanted to, you know, be a... I was an instigator. I love nothing more than, you know, finding an opportunity to get two people going at each other and manipulate that and moderate it and be right at the center of it, you see. And I just thrived on it. It's a character defect, but it gave me a sense that, hey, when the rubber hits the road, man, I'm alive right here. Alcohol sort of heightened that effect. It gave me, you know, if I had at least one can of beer in me, any teen club I walked into, I went from a pimple-faced kid whose hair was sticking up in the back, who didn't have quite the right shirt on, to, you know, I was cool. I was absolutely squared away. I didn't worry about it anymore. I knew what to say. I wasn't worried about having confidence to ask, you know, a girl to dance. And I didn't care what I looked like when I danced, which was a big concern, you know. Practicing in a mirror, you remember all that stuff, don't you? You know? Making sure you look cool. And when you're at the teen club and you're, you know, and you're high and so on and feeling good, you didn't care about that. So alcohol, in a sense, it didn't bring me any closer really to anyone, but it certainly gave me a sensation that, you know, I fit in. It solved my problems. It was, in a sense, the elixir that many of us probably craved and needed in order to sort of smooth out those life problems that we would have had whether we were drinking or not. So as I later came to realize, my problem might be a personality problem, that my problem might be related to, you know, how I functioned in the world rather than alcohol. I had trouble with that. I wanted to, I fully well expected that when I stopped using alcohol, that all my problems would go away. That now I put my finger on it. I became willing at least to say alcohol is my problem and I'm willing to do something about it. And now, you know, I'm going to be fine. I'll resume being that perfect, squared away person that I know I always was. Well, many of you might realize, having been in the program for a while, new people you might not, that as you come into the program, alcohol really may not be your problem. I mean, it's a problem in the sense that I couldn't say no to it and I didn't want to stop. That was a problem. But I mean, when I put the alcohol down, I still had a problem. I needed a solution to my life difficulties that didn't just start when I was drinking. I had a problem with compensation. I needed to compensate in my life for those flaws and insecurities and aspects of my being that I interpreted that they weren't sufficient. You know, I wasn't doing it well enough and so forth. And you'd get plenty of feedback from other people as well that would always put the pressure on you to be a little bit more perfect. So my drinking, I did go to college. I drank and didn't get into a whole lot of trouble there. It's probably one of the reasons that I got through. I started teaching part-time in 1976. I was wearing a lot of mean disco clothes. I had it going on. In today's parlance, the kids of today would say I was, what is it, at the near edge of total fatness, P-H-A-T, fat. It was fat. Baby. It was fat. The more polyester, the better. And hanging out and drinking in the, well, some of you may relate to that experience of being there in the 70s with the collars out to here. You just touch them out here. You know? That whole thing. Yeah. And I found something else that seemed to help my drinking, because, of course, the way that I like to drink, I really found that what was true for me, and it took me a while to recognize this, my favorite drink was the next one. Or it was your drink. I never really was content. You know, I had a problem. I was never content being right where I was at when I was there. I was always thinking about, what am I going to do in 10 minutes or the next thing? I was thinking about how I'm going to make this drink a little bit better, right? And how I'm going to, you know, order this. Are you ordering that? Are you getting a free drink? Or, I, you know, and I'd want drinks backed up so I didn't have to wait. You could do that, you know, if you're at these disco places and so forth. I mean, drinking was wide open. And other things as well that helped you to sort of maintain that nice, easy cruise control. You know the one I'm talking about, where you got the fun dials, you know, you're tweaking them just to maintain that perfect, that line, man, like you're bringing in a big bird and I just need to cruise it on in. I didn't want to get too drunk. I didn't want to get too agitated. And I wanted to be right there in the zone. And as much as I tried to do that, I could not stay there. I could not stay there. And for the length of time that I got there, it wasn't enough. It was never enough. I was always having to tweak them dials and manipulate and think about, you know, how I was going to do this differently and so forth. And, man, it was an example of my real disease and defects run riot, which was that I had trouble being in my own skin. The alcohol was, you know, a way of medicating and solving that problem in a temporary sense for me. It certainly wasn't really my problem. I started making alcohol. My hobby really got going when I decided that I would make beer. A real connoisseur of fine liquors and beers makes their own. Wine was too difficult, took too long. You could whip out a batch of beer in as little as, well, you could drink it after four hours of fermentation. It was a little bit cloudy, but if you strained it through a loaf of Wonder Bread, it was just fine. I'm kidding, I never did that. I heard that from sailor, you know, military kid, you talk to sailors occasionally. The sailors seem to be having the party most of the time. Sailors had it going on. They were always in ports where that to me was like, wow, the whole mystique of just kind of hanging and swashbuckling with the guys and drinking and, you know, and it never seemed to be as good when I was doing it. Somebody else was always having more fun than me. So, you know, I started making beer. I had a lot of friends when I made beer because they loved to come by, and it was something about, you know, if you're making your own home brew, you don't feel like you can charge people for it or ask them to put in their share or something. It's like, you know, baking bread and taking some over to the neighbors and so forth. They feel like they can come by any time and, hey, you got some of that home brew? You know, and I go, oh, yeah. And if I didn't have enough home brew, you know, I'd get a keg. If I had a batch brewing, I'd get a keg of, you know, the other stuff, sort of the really light American style beers, big old keg of that. That'd get me through that patch till, you know, a really good batch of homebrew was done, and I'd be squared away. I had a refrigerator. I had the thing running into the house. I had CO2. Man, I was an engineer. You know, and I got dials on it where you could, like, up the pressure, more foam, less foam. I mean, me and the dials, man, I love that whole thing, you know. Playing with the substances that help you to maintain that sort of state of well-being that you hope you can continue forever. In fact, the truth about me is I hope that I could sort of proceed in this fashion until I retired, and then I would simply retire somewhere where you got an IV running down the beach and they plug it into you, and you'd be in a lawn chair, you know, and with an umbrella, and I'd have an alcoholic retirement. I thought that would be cool. And the greatest thing about that retirement was, notice this, the implication is I didn't think I was going to die. In fact, my drinking was going to go on and on and on. I wasn't going to be lucky enough to die, you see. I was going to have to continue doing this for an extended period of time. And the idea seemed okay because, frankly, I had no other interpretation of how to live life other than a drinking life. For me, as it says in the book, the drinking life became the normal life for me. I did everything connected with alcohol. If you didn't drink, I wasn't interested really in hanging around with you. If the party wasn't about drinking, I'd go there for a short while, but I'd be loaded before I got there. I knew where to hide the booze, how to, you know, I'd take booze into a theater with me and cough when you pop the can and so on. But it wasn't just one can. I'd want like three cans, you know, in the jacket and so forth. I didn't like going to the theater because I started to come down toward the end of the movie, whatever it was. It didn't happen. Screw it, man. And I needed a drink. You know that deep down thirst? You know the one. The one where, man, I mean, it's a hole that you got to fill with something. And I couldn't put enough booze in that hole. You know, my experience with drinking continued to get worse. I was in a PhD program, psychology, and at UC Davis. And the thing I liked most about that was I wasn't at home and I could drink on the nights that I was away from home. I lived here and drove to Davis. Can you imagine? That's an insane thing to do. It was a recipe for disaster for me. And I finished all my coursework. And you know what my major professor told me? I mean, I had done all the coursework. I had a 90-page proposal ready to go. I took one orals exam already, and they said, well, you did okay. But they told me that my general attitude, I was very cavalier. I acted as if this was just going to be another one of the rubber stamp experiences of success, and that they had serious doubts as to whether this proposal or the continuation of my program was going to happen. And as an alcoholic at the time, although I wouldn't have told you that I was, what do you mean cavalier? I mean, I expect things to get done the way I want them to get done, and what do you mean? Somebody's going to stand in my way? I was filled with this belligerent denial, not only about the problem that I had, but about how it was affecting my life. I could not see that this continuous pattern of drinking had really eroded some of the values that had originally been grounded into me. I expected them to just give me what I wanted, right? And I can see that as an alcoholic characteristic. In a lot of the behavior that happened before that experience and after. So I didn't get the PhD. That was a major blow to me, but I was working part-time as a tree estimator, and I decided, you know what? Screw the education. I'm gonna sell. I'll make money anyway. I was still teaching part-time. I had the backdrop of doing that, And I hung with people who really knew how to drink. I mean, these guys were, they were tree guys. Tree guys know how to drink. I think there are only three groups that know how to drink more than tree guys. It's like roofers, tar and gravel people, and carnival workers. Okay? So I was hanging out with the, you know, people who were going to finish my graduate alcoholic training, right? And I started going at it, man. And the last 8 years of my drinking were filled with all sorts of deceptions. The double life experience was just, I cannot believe that I got away with, or at least in my mind, I thought I was getting away with all the shit I was doing. It was amazing to me. I was obsessed with alcohol. I thought about alcohol when I went to work in the morning. They sell alcohol on the radio in the morning, if you've noticed. You know, they're selling you what you're going to get after you get off work. And I was that kind of alcoholic because I drank every day. Every day was a good day for drinking. This business about taking a day off, I tried that one time. I told my wife at that time that, okay, your complaints about my drinking, I'll take one day off and then one day on, see, and I can do that. But I found that on the day off, I would wait till 12 o'clock at night. Right after 12 o'clock, it was technically the next day, and I would drink what I needed to drink because I had trouble sleeping on the nights I didn't drink. That was a little bit of a clue that my hobby had started kind of sucking back a little bit. It was consuming me. So ultimately, my situation sort of hit a bottom in 1993. I went to work one day and somebody called me in my office after I was done with my class and they said, "Are you in your office?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Who is this?" And they hung up the phone and process server showed up. Bam, here's your papers. My wife at the time was 13 years was filing for divorce. I found out she'd been having an affair with my friend across the street. I wasn't laughing like that at the time. You know what I mean? I was a little upset. I thought to myself, how did that happen? And I got to tell you the truth. What I was thinking about was, okay, this will blow over, no big deal. But I'm going to have to go to my mom's, and that means I can stay out Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. Nobody's going to, you know, kids are taken care of. Man, this is going to be perfect. And I got a few clothes, and I thought about drinking, but you know, it was a weekend where I drank enough to get drunk, but it didn't happen. Party was over. I no longer had that shield of the comfortable life where I could hide behind it and, you know, have this sense of that, you know, I would be taken care of. You know, the codependency in a sense was over. I was on my own, and for the first time, I got a glimpse. I got that moment of clarity on a Sunday night. I'm looking, going back to work, and I'm looking at a drink, and I'm not drunk, although I should have been drunk. And I thought, this is how it's going to be. And I'm going down. If I can't do something here to help myself, I'm going down. I had gone to a counselor as a way of shooting an angle and, you know, making it work a little longer. A counselor was a psychologist. And I was more intelligent, of course, than that person in my mind. And I'm, you know, it was a big joke to me. She said, how long have you been drinking? And I told her. She was writing everything down. She said, what's the longest period of sobriety that you've had? And I said, about 13 years. She said, 13 years? That's impressive. When was that? I said, from the time I was born till I was 13. See, and I laughed, and she just went, you know, the stuff that was funny for me and my drinking buddies, you know, those companions And those guys always told me I loved it, man. They said, you don't drink that much, man. We drink a lot more than you. You're not an alcoholic. But I knew. There was a part of me in my heart of hearts that knew I was an alcoholic. Deep down. And I came in here You know, I looked in one of those books and I came in here. It wasn't in this room. It was at room 102. You know, everybody says room 47, you know. But I came into room 102, El Paseo. You got to have a room too, El Paseo people. You know what I'm saying? Room 102. So I came in there. I sat behind some big dude because I didn't want anybody to see me. See? Because I was scared. I was scared and I did something I pray that you won't do. I didn't reach out my hand. I didn't participate. I had really had a life experience of not wanting to look like I didn't fit in. So I wasn't a joiner of anything. You know, I didn't join the clubs and participate in the way that, you know, a lot of kids, I guess normal kids do as they're growing up. I sort of hung on the fringe because I thought, well, I don't want to make a fool of myself. And here's another opportunity. I'm worried about my pride. I'm a psychologist. I'm in an AA meeting for a solution. You know, the bottoms up club, like the people who are here, like it ain't working anymore. And they're having fun. It was a Monday night. John C. was up here at the podium. They were giving out chips. I was wondering what the heck is going on. I listened. You know, I kind of cowered and was worried about, you know, whether somebody was going to, like, call on me or, you know, whether I'd be recognized. And when they said, are you new? Are there any new people? I didn't want to stand up. I didn't do that for a while. I wanted to get out of there. But something somebody said, like, look, don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle happens, caught my eye. I thought, come back to another meeting. Okay, I'll come back one more night. I thought it was going to be a party like that every night, you know, the Monday night. The next night, I was like, a little anticlimactic. Jeez. It was the Tuesday night open podium meeting. And I thought, okay, sit through this, and I started to get into the stories. I thought, man, if I just come back for one thing, it'll be the stories that these people tell, because this is good stuff. I mean, where else can you hear stuff like this? Not that, you know, I'm an alcoholic or anything, but I knew that really this, you know, the whole thing was over for me. But I was going to try, like most new people that come in, they hang on to that idea. Like most alcoholics, that someday they're going to be able to drink normally again. That had to be smashed, and it takes time for that to be smashed. So, about 2 weeks of coming into meetings, something happened to me. I got a little glimpse of that Charlie that used to be there, the Charlie that had been submerged by years of drinking, you know, under the alcohol, a little bit of hope. I'd actually gone a period of 2 weeks without drinking anything, and I had also had an entire day where the obsession to drink had been lifted. And I didn't realize it till later. I said, God, you know what? I went the whole damn day and I didn't think of a drink. And I mean, I got to tell you, I thought of a drink every day. Every day. That was what I had slowly and surely been coming to live for. You know, all of my rewards were drinking. And so I had that experience. I got a sponsor, Tim C., my first sponsor. And, you know, I saw this sign up here also. I'm responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there. For that, I'm responsible. And a tear almost came to my eye when I read that, because I thought, I'm home, really, but I'm going to kind of not take my shoes off yet. I'm going to see how it is. I'm going to hang in there. My sponsor made me a deal. Hey, you know, if you can go 90 days, I said, how about 3 weeks? He goes, how about four? Okay, go 4 weeks. 4 weeks became six. I went 6 weeks without a drink. And he said, if your life doesn't start to get better, then you've saved up some money, and you know, I will encourage you to go back out and get loaded. And I thought, hey, that's okay. Take a little break. But I got to tell you, my life did get better. My life has gotten steadily better from the moment I came in here to this night. I have real friendships with people. I mean, I'm actually close to people in a way that isn't driven by alcohol. My friendships that I had, I mean, most of the friends that I drank with, I don't associate with those people anymore. It's not that, you know, that I don't want to see them. They kind of lost interest in me. You know, what happened? Party was over. I've got priceless relationships in this group. This is my home group. I mean, I'm sitting here up here tonight telling you that I am grateful for what used to be a liability. My alcoholism is an asset to me. I am able to essentially turn what was a life-ending destruction, something that I saw as the end of my life. I can't drink anymore. What am I going to do? What the hell am I going to do? I slowly but surely found that I was being transformed. The thing I loved about the program was that it was an action program. People weren't victims in here. They weren't looking for pity, anybody's pity. They reached out their hand for help if they were willing. I encourage you to do that. The sooner you do that, the sooner we can begin to, as we need to, pass this message on to you. That's how the program works. I heard Mike today at the noon meeting. He was saying, I don't care about the failure rate in Alcoholics Anonymous, because as far as I'm concerned, the rate is 100% success for me. I haven't had a drink today. That still amazes me for someone that pretty much consigned myself to a lifetime process of drinking. You know, that's where I was going. I haven't had a drink today. I started to develop relationships with my children. I rebuilt my life. I love going to work. I mean, that was something that I got to tell you. I usually started getting wound up on Thursday night, drank heavy Friday night. Saturday night just blew it out. Taper on Sunday. Taper Monday. Oh, you know, got to have a little smoothing action right after work. And, you know, I wasn't feeling right till Wednesday. And then Wednesday I was looking towards that first night I could drink, was Thursday night, because I didn't work on Fridays. Beautiful thing. Man, you know, I had it down. But I didn't have to engage in that long-term maintenance of my drinking habit. I had experiences with colleagues at work that were, you know, connections that I hadn't even gotten into before. I'd seen those people as my enemies. I'd never given them a chance. I'd never been a worker among workers, really. You know, I was a loner. People were out to get me. I felt better in my own skin. I could sit still for an entire hour through a meeting. I was starting to recover physically from the effects of alcoholism. My life today, if I had, if I had to predict it or write the screenplay for my life today, then I would have cut myself way short, way short. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And in a meeting here, I heard Billy say, not this Billy, but Billy from L.A., he said one time, quoted out of the Bible, Book of Joel, which I thought, whoa, wait a minute. You know, Bible quotations here at the podium. He said, God will return to you the years the locust has eaten. Man, that got me right here. What do you mean? God's going to give back to me all that time I wasted? Because here I was, I felt like, man, I burned up a lot of my life drinking booze. I could already see that. You know, I wasted so much time. But I got to tell you, I've gotten an opportunity to relive those things that I've lost. I have a priceless relationship with a woman that I met, a relationship not initially based on sex, drugs, and alcohol. Rock and roll can be thrown in there too. I mean, it was an intimacy, and it was a form of communicating with another human being I didn't even think I was mature enough to engage in. You know, I could read my children a story at night without cutting it short because I needed a drink. Right? I have a new daughter 3 months old. And I'm re-experiencing, I have 3 sons also. That's something I probably would have never done. Drunk, for sure. Who would have had me? I don't have to worry about the police today. I don't have to worry about the IRS today. I don't go to bed at night and worry about, you know, who I screwed over. These are just a few of the little, you know, gifts that I've been given. And I encourage you, don't hide out in here. Don't hide out. Join in. Even though they may seem at times stuck up, cliquish, and too cool for school, they're living life. These people in AA, they're living life. And you know those people out on the outside? They don't care what goes on in here. That's for us. That's for us, if you be alcoholic. We have a solution here that can deliver to you a spiritual connection. That's what all this is about. It is a formula for delivering to you a spiritual connection. The book is getting a sponsor, doing the steps, cleaning house, working with others, coming to meetings, which I need to do to be reminded that God has a plan for me, that power greater than myself, wherever yours is, has a plan for you. So, by all means, do not sell yourself short. I'd like to just close with one little quote out of the book that I found to be a sort of a perfect statement of where I came from and where I am today. Above all, we rejected fantasizing and accepted reality. The more I drank, the more I fantasized everything. I imagined getting even for hurts and rejections. In my mind's eye, I played and replayed scenes in which I was plucked magically from the bar, where I stood nursing a drink, and was instantly exalted to some position of power and prestige. I lived in a dream world. AA led me gently from this fantasizing to embrace reality with open arms. I found it beautiful, for at last I was at peace with myself and with others and with God. Thanks for letting me share.